Okay, I'm going to welcome you to come in and get seated. And we have a couple minutes before our next speaker. For those that are just joining the group, I'll kind of set the stage again, a little reminder of what we're doing. This is a session that's taking a broad look at adapting cropping systems to drought. And in the first session, before the break, we had a presentation on climate forecasting and climate reporting. And kind of the takeaway I took from that was that there's some excellent resources available for understanding in a particular geographic area what the risk of climate of drought is, how severe that risk is, what the likely recurrence periods of drought are. So I thought the presentation was very, very good, very interesting. We had another presentation on cropping systems, basically cultural practices, things that you could alter on in the cropping system, rotations, planting structure, tillage practices that might benefit the producer in the occurrence of drought conditions. And then our last two presentations were addressing practices that might improve the capability of the soil to retain water. And again, if you didn't hear me before, I'm collecting a summary of kind of bullet points for a news reporter that wants to know the outcome of this session. Those two were both challenging. The cover crop discussion that Dr. Turco led us through showed some really interesting benefits to the soil in the form of biological diversity and resilience, but not any immediate benefits to water retention or crop water uptake. And something kind of similar in the biochar story, the second of the two soils talks, looking like there are some improvements in overall soil health. But the challenge with the biochar is it looks like it's increasing water holding capacity at both the field capacity and the wilting point side of things, which might make water even slightly more scarce in some situations. So what we're going to do now is shift gears and talk about the crop side of drought. So we've looked at managing a farming system and soils. Our first speaker in this section is Dr. Stephen Bainziger from the University of Nebraska.
Thank you. And I want to thank the organizers for inviting me. Can you all hear me? Okay. And then the question I want to ask is, how many of you are plant breeders or work with plant breeders? Oh, man. Okay, we've got quite a group now. Okay. So we know to whom to address the questions. Okay. I want to acknowledge my co-author, Wasim, who's in the audience. Okay. Now, what I want to do is talk about plant breeding as it relates to drought. And I think the first thing you need to consider is you have to pick your target carefully. You know, we have an expression, if you don't know where you're going, any road will get you there. And that's basically when you talk about drought tolerance, you really need to define it. Once you do that, every breeding program has basically three steps. The first one is you introduce variation. The second part is you allow that variation to segregate or separate. That's usually done by inbreeding. And then finally, you evaluate the best variants to see whether or not they're worthy of release. The process for winter wheat takes 12 years if you're using a conventional program, 7 years if you're using doubled haploids. So you should be looking at a time span of 7 to 12 years. That's the window, and that's what you have to look at. Now, I want you to look at this table, or this chart, and it's, to me, very important because the x-axis, let's see if I can do this. Yeah, okay, the x-axis is your moisture during the cropping season. Your y-axis is the grain yield, and then the line is your theoretical limit based on your moisture, okay? And all the dots are what growers actually had. And the part that's most interesting to me will be the dots that are connected by lines, because that's the same genotype, different cultural practice at the same location. So that gives you an idea of what a cultural practice effect can do for your water relationship as how close you get to the line. So when I look at this, it tells me the drought is extremely dependent on the genotype by environmental interaction. And it also tells me that quite often, I didn't do it, honest. Okay? I just wanted to spotlight this slide. So anyway, it also tells me that the management becomes absolutely critical. Okay? And this slide is a little different, but it's very similar. And in this case, the open circles are the simulated yields. So if you're assuming in the first slide everything's based on water, now you're incorporating all the other physical parameters you'd have in a cropping system model. Okay? And you can see that you do have some deviation from that theoretical line, but it's really nothing like what the growers are seeing. Now, I never assume a grower is ignorant. What I assume is a grower makes risk management decisions. This is Australia data. They are probably expecting a 1 to 2 ton crop. They fertilize it. If they get enough moisture to have an 8 ton crop, fertilizer becomes limited. Okay? And that's part of how you look at water use efficiency in a way. Is it the most limiting effect or is it something different? Now, every data point tells a story, and what a breeder has to do is to make sense out of those what that story is. Okay? John Passiori, who's one of the great drought physiologists of all time, described drought as a lifestyle disease. It's the thing that accumulates over time. You have everything that drought affects is cumulative, and the end point is what normally we measure as yield, but how we get there becomes critical. So I like to look at what stages are you breeding for, okay? And the other question you have to ask is, are those stages independent genetically of each other? So that you may have one genetic system that you need for early drought. You may have a completely different genetic system that you need for terminal drought or drought at flowering. They may be independent, which means you can combine them. And that's actually quite common. You know, if you breed for alkaline soils, the genetics in wheat are different than if you breed for acid soils. There are different genes that control that. So you can breed a wheat that's acid soil tolerant and alkaline soil tolerant. Not a problem. In rice, the submergence 1 gene, which means you can have a monsoon and be flooded for under a meter of water for 2 weeks and the crops still survive, is completely independent of drought tolerance genes. So you can breed rice that is submergence tolerant and drought tolerant, and put them together. And that's something the breeders work with because we want to pyramid genes to the abiotic stresses we have to work with. So in Nebraska, the 2 key times that we really have to work on drought, the first one is at emergence, and this is a yield trial, and you can see how poor the emergence is due to spatial variation, which some of the previous speakers described. The other time is at flowering, which is here. And that's true because reproduction is the absolutely most physiological sensitive stage for things like kernel abortion. Kernels per square meter is usually the driving force of grain yield in a cereal. Okay? And again, the genetic control can be different. Now, I want to bring up something which may be counterintuitive. But most of our drought tolerant, or most of our irrigated wheats, in fact, need to be drought tolerant. That sounds crazy, but the answer is, until you have these really good sensors, which we heard earlier, many of our growers assume they have enough moisture to finish the crop. So you build this very dense crop, and then you miss the last irrigation, and you put it into a terminal drought. So, again, it's a lifestyle disease. Part of the lifestyle is how much water are you prepared to use. If your crop is expecting that water and you don't give it to it, it'll notice it. So drought tolerance takes on different meanings depending upon what you're looking at. Now, drought is probably one of the worst traits to measure. Okay? Spatial variation is huge. We say it's difficult to have a uniformly good field. It's virtually impossible to have a uniformly poor field. Drought tolerance would be a uniformly poor field. Okay? So how do you get a more uniform field? Well, you can do it by rainout shelters. But it's kind of hard to do that on the scope and scale that a plant breeder needs. When we're looking at 10 hectares, it's a pretty big rainout shelter, right? Okay? So most of them go to irrigation in the deserts. And even there, you have to make sure your irrigation system doesn't have spatial variation. Now, uniformity is important. It's a cue, I guess. Uniformity is important because heritability, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but heritability is basically, if you select a parent, the higher the heritability, the more likely the progeny will look like that parent. Okay, so it makes your selection work. If you had zero heritability, your progeny would look nothing like your parents. If you had a heritability of one, your parent and your progeny would be identical. Okay? And only point I want to make is when you're thinking about drought and uniformity is what determines heritability. Well, it's the additive genetic variance divided by the phenotypic variance. And you can break that out. These are all your genetic variances. The G by E, which would include G by M, and your error variance, which is what your spatial variance would give you. So that's why we spend so much time trying to correct for spatial variation. Anything that reduces our heritability reduces our gain, which is this equation up here. Okay? And again, I don't want you to understand these equations. The breeders already know them, and the rest of you, there's no need to. But the point is heritability is fundamental to selection. And one of the things that we need to think about is, as I said, drought tolerance is extremely difficult to breed for. Its heritability is extremely low. So if you go to the literature, you will see indirect selection. What that means is breeders have said, I can't breed for drought tolerance. So I will take a trait that is genetically correlated to drought tolerance, but the heritability is higher, and that's what I'll breed for. And I'll use that to estimate or to get try to improve drought tolerance. And the only equation you need to look at is this one right here. So the H sub Y is the indirect trait you're selecting for. It might be seeds per spike. Okay? The H sub X would be what you'd like to select for, say grain yield. And the R X sub Y is the genetic correlation between the two traits. If the R X of Y, which goes from 0 to 1, times the heritability of Y is greater than the heritability of your directly selected trait, you use indirect selection. Now, is that common? Absolutely. This is the way molecular markers work. Your molecular markers have extremely high heritability. They're correlated to the trait that they're tagging. And it's much easier to select for molecular markers for a number of reasons besides this than it is for, say, drought tolerance. And so that's why molecular markers are used. It's a form of indirect selection. Now, the reason why I bring that up is that you will read in the literature a lot about indirect selection in breeders. Okay? And again, it's relating to the heritabilities, direct selection versus indirect. And the biggest one is the assumption that you get much higher heritabilities, which is true, in high-yielding environments. And that because you get so much higher heritability, and if the genes work in high-yielding environments, they probably will work in low-yielding environments, breed for high-yielding environments, and then grow the types in the low-yielding environments. That works as long as you don't ever see a crossover interaction, but as long as you see, you know, a parallel or a change in magnitude, that's perfect, okay? And what you'll see is that every crop will look at this, and it's really crop-specific. So I come from wheat, and I will never believe in the indirect selection in the high-yielding environments because that's our semi-dwarfs. For the really drought-prone environments, you need the long coleoptiles. You may need the greater height, all of which says you do a non-semi-dwarf wheat. So we completely change the plant architecture when we're breeding for drought. Don't have to, but you can, than when you're breeding for the higher yielding environments. And that's the kind of thing. So when you read that corn says, well, we'll breed for the high yielding environments and it'll work in the low yielding. Or sorghum, same thing. Soybeans, the same thing. They're not changing the planopy architecture for the environment. But if you do that, then this approach of indirect selection, breeding in the highly heritable sites, won't work. Okay? And so you just need to be aware of that as you read the literature of how breeders approach things. My breeding targets are four. Has to survive the winter or winter wheat. Has to survive stem rust. Has to have good agronomics and has to make a loaf of bread. Okay? Now, one of the things that I do think we have to look at is breeders usually talk about one crop. I breed three, wheat, barley, and triticale. Barley is much more drought tolerant than wheat. The reason why barley isn't grown in Nebraska is because it doesn't have the winter hardiness that we need consistently. But a legitimate question would be, would I be better off, would the growers of Nebraska be better off, if I bred drought-tolerant wheat or winter-hardy barley? I mean, that's a question. And most people, when they talk cropping systems, they don't ask that question. There are alternatives you can use. Here's where we grow or test our crop. Approximately one-third is in the east, one-third is in the southwest, one-third is in the west. In the east, it's a corn-soybean system with wheat thrown in. In the southwest, it's a wheat-corn-fallow system. And in the far west, it's wheat-fallow-wheat. Okay? When it really gets dry, you take out the corn and you put in sorghum. There's a gradient that runs across the state. This is usually 4 to 5 metric tons per hectare. This would be 2 metric tons per hectare. So, three stages. You introduce variation, segregate and select, evaluate and release. How do you incorporate drought tolerance into this breeding pipeline? Well, the first thing is you have to introduce the variation. Most of us do that through crossing hybridization. You use a drought tolerant parent. It's rare that you're going to get, by luck, drought tolerance by crossing two lines that have no drought tolerance at all. Okay? You can do mutations, but they're very hard to find. Gene editing will be much more valuable in the future as we have a better scope of the genes underlying drought tolerance. You can do transgenics. And of course, in crops like wheat, even though we don't have any genetically engineered transgenic crops, we move whole chromosome arms from alien species into wheat. And of course, that doesn't count as being transgenic. But that little chromosome arm has more DNA than the Arabidopsis genome. Just saying, but it's okay. Okay? So that's the first stage. The second stage is how do we allow it to inbreed and how do we make our selections? All the small grains are self-pollinated. We just let them self. That allows the segregation to occur. If you want to speed it up, you do doubled haploids or you do single seed descent, and that just aids you in the timing. If you've never seen a doubled haploid, this is what it looks like. It's wheat. You take a gamete, you double its chromosome, you have an immediate inbred line done very, very quickly. Again, getting back to selection. And the point is, where you have large numbers, 50,000 head rows, it's all done visually. Okay? As soon as you can narrow it down, you start using machines to assist you. In my program, we cut every plot in the preliminary observation nursery. We do that because it's convenient and we need the grain. And when we get the grain, we get the yield. Okay? We drop some of those before we weigh them because if they've got disease susceptibility, they're not the right maturity, height, etc. But of those we weigh that look good, we'll do a test weight. We just have this sort of trickle-down hierarchy. If it has good test weight, then we'll do a protein and a kernel hardness. And then we'll advance on the above. We're also using genomic selection, but that's a little bit beyond the scope of this talk. Okay? Now, we're also using other machines now. We're trying to use things like canopy spectral reflectance, because that appears to be something you can measure water status. And basically, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on exactly how we do it, other than to acknowledge that the Center for Ag Land Management Information Technologies, which is at the University of Nebraska, was extremely helpful in this. But basically, you take your canopy spectral reflectance. This sends the data to a backpack, which is here. That backpack Wi-Fi's it to a computer. If you wanted to, you could have that. You could have that computer. Whoops, wrong way. That computer will upload it to a satellite directly into your server. It's a way of getting an objective measurement of water status. That's what's critical. Personally, I like the UAVs and I like the aerial. This happens to be from an airplane. You get your whole field instantaneously. I mean, you can look at this. This is multiple plots. The other part that I like about this is we don't talk about it, but everything, how are we doing on time? Okay. Everything we have here is GPS planted. So all those lines and alleyways you see lined up, that's everything's done by a tractor and a planter, and all I have to do is dump seed. So we can geo-reference every plot in the trial. And you can see over here, very obviously, you've got a winter kill situation. You get a lot of good data that way. We have a lot of diversity. Breeding programs run on genetic variation. You better have diversity. This is the same nursery, four different years, new crosses, new materials going into the preliminary yield trial. Each colored dot is a different year. You can see that there's no clusters, which means we can use genomic selection. Don't worry about that. The key point is we have a lot of diversity. We don't want to lose our diversity. We don't want to narrow it so we can't make improvements. So you have diversity. Do you advance it? There was a red cluster, a black cluster, and a blue cluster, and the green dots are the lines advanced to the next nursery. They came from all three clusters. So we do have diversity. We do use diversity. We do advance it. So we go into the segregation and selection, better assays. That's what's critical for drought tolerance. Marker-assisted selection, genome-wide association studies, genomic selection, high-throughput phenotyping. If you want to speed up the generation time, you use doubled haploids. I'm going to take a digression here. I want to talk about mixographs. This doesn't mean much to most of you, but it's a preliminary test for end-use quality. When you breed for end-use quality, the mills for a hardweed want this type of curve, call it 3. I don't give them a 3. I always give them a 4. Okay? They want 300 for a falling number. Don't worry about that. It's an estimate of sprout tolerance. Okay? I give them a 500. The reason being, under drought, a curve that's a 4 tends to become a curve that's a 3. The way the kernel filling is you weaken the dough strength. So I always give them some insurance so that they can always have good quality flour. If I bred specifically for what they want and you had drought, it would be a 2. And the only way you get a 2 back to a 3 is to blend it with a 4. So you always give them something more. That's part of the breeding for drought tolerance. Now, the evaluation, and this is what becomes critical when you think about drought tolerance, okay? You have to determine if a line has merit. You have to determine where it should be grown, where it shouldn't be grown. Now, these are my testing sites, okay? The key sites are the ones listed in K. The W is a key site for winter survival. M is the main nursery in western Nebraska. And the I's are just other sites that help us replicate. For winter hardiness, a key trait, if a line survives, well, thank you, at Mead, it will survive anywhere. So all I have to do is get it through Mead, and I know I've got it anywhere I want to grow that wheat. Okay? There's year-to-year variation, but Mead's always my most severe testing site. The problem for drought is I don't have that severe west testing site, that consistent one. Sometimes it's Sydney, that's where you saw the emergence from. Sometimes it's North Platte. Sometimes it's McCook. This year it's Grant. So I have all these locations trying to breed for drought tolerance, and I'm never sure where I'm going to find it. And that's a real problem when you have to work with drought. This is just a map of regional data. If you look at Nebraska, you see there are two colored dots. That's the clusters you can see, our environmental clusters. This is regional data. We have 3 clusters here. That tells me I've got 3 ecozones to breed for. This is based on regional data, 30 years of yield data, and basically how you cluster it together. It tells me the environments I have to work in. Spatial variation is huge. This is winter, okay? Does that look like something that gives you a uniform plot? That snow band that runs right through it, that acts as insulation against winter killing. When it thaws, it gives you more moisture. Do you think I laid out my reps to follow that snow band? Not likely. This is what a droughted field looks like. The same situation. How do you lay out your design when you have this kind of variability in the field? And yet that's exactly the location you want to breed for drought tolerance in. So when you get to the evaluation and release, cropping systems are critical. You have to work with agronomists. The biometry, the spatial variation, the tools we use to remove it. And then modeling, because we don't test everywhere, but we can simulate where we don't test. So that becomes very, very important. The decision to release, it should be better for at least one economically important trait than any existing cultivar. And we will do that, cut it a little slack, if it adds diversity for disease and insect resistance so our crop's not vulnerable. Now, I'm going to end on two slides. This is how you make money on wheat in Nebraska right now. Okay? But a good past is positively dangerous if it makes us content with the present and unprepared for the future. And so as you go forward with climate change, we really have to build resiliency. And there's a great African proverb, if you want to go fast, you go alone. If you want to go far, you go together. And so I'd like to acknowledge the people we work with. This is what our standard breeding team looks like. A lot of genetics, plant pathology, variety testing, transformation, entomology, phenotyping, cropping systems, end-use quality, biometry, statistics, modeling. We work with triticale barley, and we acknowledge our funding sources. With that, I'll stop and say thank you.
We do have time for a couple questions.
Let's see, one way in the back. We don't. It's an expensive assay. However, you know, to be quite honest with you, if we had an inexpensive assay, we definitely would. You know, Graham Farquhar and the Australians have proven that it works extremely well. So, yeah, that's an excellent way of doing it. It's just we don't have the resources. Okay.
Another question.
Emerson.
What kind of drought? What's the best kind for selection?
Okay. And I got to tell you something, Emerson, because this is something which may be counterintuitive, too. When we have drought in eastern Nebraska, that's when we get the highest yields. And the reason is because we have solar radiation. We usually have enough water holding retention to finish the crop. You don't think you do, but you actually do. And then that solar radiation, and that's when we hit the 7-8 metric ton crop. Okay? So the best kind of drought would be one that's uniform. And the best kind of drought is one that fits the target you're shooting for. So if I had consistently a drought in western Nebraska that was at 1.5 metric tons per hectare, that would be perfect because that's the historic yield values. When it fluctuates up and around that, it's either telling me not enough or telling me too much. Okay? And I suppose if you, as a breeder, you would want something that takes a very narrow range and allows it to be widened so you can see it more easily. Winter killing's obvious. If it's dead, I don't harvest it. There's no seed of that line. It's gone. That's what makes me good. It's more winter hardiness than I need, but it's such a clean separation. If I could have a drought that would give me that clean separation where anything that was sort of weak was dead and anything that was semi-strong was vigorous, that would be perfect. But I don't have that. Okay. Did that answer your question, Emerson? Okay. In that case, the way I would answer your question, Emerson, is I would want an estimate of drought that is biologically and physiologically meaningful. So again, the most sensitive time for drought is usually at flowering or at emergence. And those would be the times where I would like to look at what your water holding capacity in the soil at the time of emergence, because that can tell you what can emerge with less water. Okay. And you'd want to know precisely what's happening at flowering in the water status of the soil and the plant, because again, that would tell you physiologically what your end point was. It explains the life cycle. It's the idea that if you smoke 20 years, you probably have lung problems at the end, right? If we're only measuring that you have lung problems at the end, you don't know why. You do want to know that you smoke 20 years.